Thank you very much, Layla. Good morning, everybody. I know everybody here is interested in nature contact, but I have to ask you, don't get distracted by looking out the windows of this room during the presentation at all the trees. Well, I'm going to begin our panel this morning by talking about the evidence that we have for the health benefits of nature contact. I have to disclose first that I have absolutely no financial interest in what I'm about to say. Let's do an opinion poll. We'll look at your use of evidence and your own belief system. Raise your hand if you believe the statement that's up there. Almost everybody in the room. Raise your hand if you believe that lowering cholesterol with statins reduces the risk of heart attacks. So not everybody's voting yes. Raise your hand if you believe no. And raise your hand if you just don't have the evidence to be able to vote. Okay, so this is an evidence-based crowd. Raise your hand if you think vegetarian diets are healthier than meat-based diets. So you probably know something about this. Raise your hand if you don't believe it's true. A few of you, and raise your hand if you don't have enough evidence to have an opinion. Okay. Now raise your hand if you believe this. So this is very interesting. Much stronger belief in this room for this statement than for the previous completely true statements. So we'll talk about how we build our belief systems based on evidence. Now, the use of evidence in building our belief systems isn't new. Buddha recommended this quite some time ago at one of the very first APHA meetings. These are his words here. There is a theoretical basis to believe that nature contact is good for health, and it goes back to the early days of evolution. Evolution is pictured here. Or here, alternatively, there are competing theories of how evolution has actually played out, and this one's a little more worrisome and more relevant to our talk today. The evolutionary basis has been called the biophilia hypothesis by E.O. Wilson, and I think many of you are probably familiar with this, the notion that we evolved embedded in nature and that there is to some extent a hardwired, the word he uses is affiliation of human beings to nature, evolutionary benefits to being able to read nature signals and to be able to find restoration from nature contact. Let me show you some of the evidence that we've got, and this is going to be nature and health evidence tapas. I'm going to give you little tastes of several bits of evidence, and then we'll put that together and draw some overall conclusions. The perfect sort of evidence that we'd love to have is a randomized clinical trial where people truly are experimented on. They're blinded to the conditions of their arm of the trial, so they don't know. They can't answer or respond based on knowing the intervention. And of course, you can't do that with nature contact very well. But some of the best studies we've got are quasi-experimental or natural experiments. Natural here, not in the sense of related to nature, but in the sense that they're just happening anyway and the investigators grab them. Here's an example. This is the State Prison of Southern Michigan, a study that was done in 1978. It's a big old Depression era structure that looks out over some rolling hills in Southern Michigan. It turns out that some of the rooms or cells looked out over the countryside, as indicated by those green diamonds. And some of the cells looked into a very barren courtyard, as indicated by the red diamonds. It was a random selection where you ended up in a cell. And the sick call rate from the interior cells was substantially higher than in the exterior cells, suggesting that maybe there was something salutary about being able to view nature routinely. This is one of the iconic studies in this field. This is Roger Ulrich's study. He looked at cholecystectomies, gallbladder removals, in a Pennsylvania hospital. And the beauty of this was that he recognized that in the surgical ward of the hospital, some of the rooms looked out at trees, and other rooms looked out at a brick wall. And it was pretty much a random matter where you were brought after your surgery for recovery. So he compared the outcomes of the tree view room patients with the brick view room patients. Found that the tree view rooms had substantially shorter hospitalizations. Interesting to note, by the way, that in those days, you would stay in the hospital for a week after a gallbladder, as opposed to current drive-through procedures. Substantially less need for pain medications and fewer negative nursing notes. So this established the idea that an outcome as hard as surgical recovery could be substantially affected by contact with nature. This is a study from Hopkins a couple of years ago. Bronchoscopy is a procedure where a fiber optic tube is inserted into the windpipe so that the physician can see the inside of the airways. It goes all the way down into the lungs. It's what doctors refer to as uncomfortable. And other people have other words for it. Typically, sedation is used, but people don't get put to sleep. So in this trial, half the people got their ordinary sedation. The other half got their ordinary sedation, plus they got the chance to view a nature scene and to hear a soundtrack corresponding to the nature scene. This was the nature scene, nothing very fancy. It was actually a big curtain like this. And the soundtrack was the sound of water rippling in the brook. And it turned out that the pain control was substantially better among those who had the nature contact. Now, you'll be thinking, as you should, well, maybe that was just the distraction. Maybe it didn't have anything to do with nature itself. And please do be thinking along those lines, because for each of these studies, there are alternative explanations available. One of my favorite bodies of work comes from Bill Sullivan and Francis Kuo at University of Illinois, who recognized an opportunity for research at the Robert Taylor Homes. Anybody here from Chicago? So you may know this. They aren't there anymore, fortunately for everybody. But this was a series of 28 high-rise identical buildings along a three-mile strip of land in Chicago, bounded by railroad tracks and by a highway. So a pretty grim place. Well, some of the buildings had trees outside them. They had all been planted originally, and in some cases the trees remained. In other cases, the folks had taken the trees down, fearing that the trees were hiding places for predators. And so there were two kinds of buildings that could be observed, those with trees nearby and those without. Where you ended up living was a matter of when your name came to the top of the list at the Chicago Housing Authority. So it essentially was a random selection. And what they found was that if you lived in a building with trees, a little bit of the methodology of their study, they only studied people on the first few floors so that there was visual contact with the trees out the windows of the apartments. They looked at the summertime only, wanting the trees to be in leaf instead of without leaves. They used community interviewers, and they were very attentive to the cultural issues in the interviews and got what seemed to be very, very solid interview data. If you lived in a building with nearby trees, you were more likely to know and greet your neighbors. You were more likely to acknowledge and help your neighbors. There was substantially less psychological aggression and violence. And the children did better in school. This is a series of about five or six papers about a decade ago. Very impressive evidence that living in buildings with nearby trees had a number of important social and health benefits. This is a study on park proximity and health from Copenhagen, Denmark. Turns out that if you stratify the people of the city according to how close they live to a park, this is the pattern you see corresponding to park visits. The closer you are to the park, the more likely you are to visit the park. This is duh. You would have guessed that. But interestingly, the closer you live to a park, the lower your self-reported levels of stress and the lower the risk of obesity. And those are relationships that could not be explained by the intervening variable of going to the park. That had a partial explanatory value. So something about living near the park means you go to the park. Going to the park reflects physical activity levels, and that may have some impact on obesity risk. But even when that was factored out, there was a health benefit to living near the parks. A study of plants in a Taiwanese junior high school, two eighth grade rooms. You can see that the one at the top had plants placed in the room, and the one at the bottom stayed without plants at its baseline condition. And the observations over 6 months indicated, in some ways, no differences. Anxiety, stress, and overall well-being didn't change. But the students liked their classroom better if it had plants in it, and the academic performance improved marginally. It's a very small study, so it may be that that academic improvement would have looked more real had the N been bigger. This is a very nice Indianapolis study, and it exemplifies the use of innovative exposure variables. We have very good land cover data for much of the country, and we have very good GIS data for much of the country, and those can be used in studies of nature contact because we can characterize green space using those databases. So this is a study of inner city children in Indianapolis. I put the background picture there to show you that they actually used land cover data to stratify neighborhoods according to how green they were. The greener the neighborhood, the less likely the children were to become obese and the slower their rates of weight gain over time. Could have been a factor of physical activity, probably wasn't a factor of social class because that was controlled for in the analysis. So something about these green inner city neighborhoods seemed to be good for kids in terms of weight gain. You may have seen this study. This is a look at urban trees and asthma in New York City, where the asthma prevalence was quantified via data from the schools and the tree density was quantified via the Parks and Recreation Tree Census, another interesting kind of exposure variable for this research. Every one standard deviation increase in tree density was associated with a 29% decrease in early childhood asthma prevalence. So this may have been an impact of the salutary impact of the trees on air quality at the micro scale, or there may have been other mechanisms as well. If you're wondering how long this is going to go on, this is a 13-course tapas meal. So we're at course number 9 now. This is a look at Tokyo neighborhoods following the health and survival of elders in Tokyo over a 5-year period of observation. Lots of variables were collected, and they were followed through till death. And of the 3,000 or so subjects, almost 900 died during the period of observation. Compared to those in the lowest category, along the variable, there is a space for taking a stroll near your home. The 5-year survival was substantially higher in those in the highest category. And the same was true independently for the variable parks and tree-lined streets near home. And this controlled for social class, did not control for physical activity levels. So there was an association between green neighborhoods and survival, mechanism still unclear. This is a very complex study, and so I wanted to ease you into it by showing you a completely blank graph. This is a look at two variables that co-vary with each other in interesting ways. This is in England. This is the greenness of neighborhoods. And what you'll see for the highest income category, which I'm showing you here, we're going to stratify by income, but even in the highest income category that you see here, the incident rate ratio of mortality, this is all-cause mortality, slightly decreases as you go from the least green to the most green neighborhoods, okay? So there's a little bit of a survival advantage as your neighborhood gets greener. This is among the wealthiest. Among the middle income group, that's the pattern that you see. So it's higher mortality across the board, but a steeper decline in association with the greenness of your neighborhoods. And in the lowest income category, the same thing again, but even more. That is higher mortality across the board, which we know, mortality being class related, but a very steep decrease in mortality as you move from the least green to the most green neighborhoods. So one interpretation of this data set is that access to green space blunts the impacts of poverty on health. Green exercise has been studied, generally in quite small studies, and here what you do is you have people take a run in a natural setting, and you have people take the same run in a built setting, and then you look at how they do. So this is one example. This is a relatively early one from Terry Hartig from 10 years ago. This is a series of perception metrics, and it turns out that the runners like and appreciate the green environment much more than they do the urban environment. So as a matter of preference, the nature run wins. As a matter of how they feel afterwards, this is the change from pre to post associated with running in nature. And you can see that the feeling of revitalization and the feeling of tranquility increased from before the run to after the run, and anxiety and depression and anger decreased. Here you see the data for those who ran in the urban setting, same impact, and it looks like there's not much difference. So this is a negative study, and I could have shown you more of these. There are quite a few of them out there. So running is good. It doesn't look in this case like there's much difference other than liking the setting better on the outcome variables of interest. And finally, a recent paper that's a really nice piece of work from University of Pennsylvania. 54,000 vacant lots were identified in Philadelphia, and the city undertook a program to green those lots. So the investigators took a look at the impact of greening the lots on the health and well-being of those who live near the lots. And they could do a before-after, and they could also compare places that weren't greened with places that were greened. Turns out that greening the lots was associated with all of the social benefits that you see there, a reduction in gun assaults, in vandalism and criminal mischief, in self-reported stress, and people who lived in the neighborhoods that got greened, or who lived near those lots, became more physically active. And these were individual lots, so not really exercise venues, but something about them inspired people to become more physically active. Oh, one more. Impact on depression. Did I just give you two number 13s? No, that was 12. Okay, good. So 20 patients with major depression, this is in Ann Arbor, walked in both a park setting and an urban setting. The walks were comparable in terms of length and physical activity, and they took tests before and after each of those walks to measure the extent of their depression and cognitive performance. And it turned out that although they started off at different levels in terms of their cognition, the nature walk had a very positive impact on cognitive performance. The urban walk did not. And they did start off at the same place in terms of negative affect, but there was more improvement. Actually, the negative affect stayed the same in the park. I think I may have put these lines backwards. The park had a better impact on negative affect than the urban walk did. I may have reversed the lines there. So that is the body of evidence. Now let's take another vote, although I don't expect it to change because it was pretty unanimous at the beginning. How many think that nature contact is good for health and well-being? Everybody does. Good. Well, it's. I would submit to you that it's a fairly scattered body of evidence. We have bits and pieces of evidence. We look at different health outcomes. Different measures of nature contact are used. In fact, this is not as tight and compelling a body of evidence as we do have for a number of other outcomes. Are we ready, thinking in biomedical terms, to write prescriptions? Are we ready to be telling people that they should go get nature contact? Do we have a strong enough base of evidence to do that? I can write you an antihypertensive prescription now, and I can tell you with a lot of confidence that the medication will be safe and efficacious, because I couldn't even prescribe it unless we had that database. But we're not quite at that point, I'd submit, with nature contact. That said, we probably know enough to act. And I'm going to plunge in the last couple of minutes into a discussion of how much is enough? How much do we have to know? How demanding should we be of the evidence that's available to us? Just a reminder that there is a Leave No Child Inside, a Reconnect Kids with Nature movement around the country. It was kind of launched and popularized by Rich Loeb's wonderful book, A Last Child in the Woods, that I hope many of you have read. And that has been extended in a second book called The Nature Principle. He's done a very nice job of popularizing a lot of the data that we've got available. And these campaigns are being carried forward by a number of organizations, both at the national level and at state and local levels. What do we still need to know? Where would the research go? Well, one question is measuring a dose of nature. How much nature is enough? How do you measure a dose? Do you need access to trees, or would shrubs do the trick? If trees, do the trees have to have leaves on them, or are they still pretty good without leaves? Do you have to be out there in contact with the trees, or is viewing them out the window okay, or would be viewing a facsimile on the screen okay? For how long do you have to be exposed? How do you measure the intensity of exposure? Are there subcategories of people, some of whom benefit more than others? For many, many interventions on health, some people benefit more than others. Is that the case for nature? Are there particular developmental windows? We now know so much about windows of vulnerability and windows of opportunity during childhood development for a number of exposures. Is that the case for nature as well? What about migrants? What if you grow up in New Mexico and move to Seattle? People do have a rooted sense of home place. So is nature contact in the Cascades outside Seattle as good for you as nature contact would be outside Albuquerque in your native New Mexico? Or are we fungible in what constitutes nature for us? And does early origin not matter? What health outcomes should we be looking at? Psychological health, performance, either academically or on the job, self-reported stress, happiness, or more conventional health outcomes? And once you get your dose of nature, for how long do the benefits last? How often do we have to prescribe that you take a dose of nature? Is it every day? Is it once a week? Does it have to be for a long time? Do short bursts help? And how does it all work? We don't know very much about the mechanisms of action. So this is a very large research agenda. And many of these questions remain unanswered, even by the sorts of studies that I showed you, which are, in the aggregate, a pretty good reflection of the research out there. So where should we go with research? How much should we be doing? Is it fair to demand of the National Institutes of Health that substantial sums be diverted from pharmacologic research to research on the health benefits of nature contact? You might argue that we don't need to do any more research. And you might argue that because, after all, a room of very well-informed people unanimously believes already that nature contact is good for health, so it's time just to go ahead and make policy. Or you might argue that we need more research. Well, one of the points, and I've just got two closing points, and this is the first, it actually matters how strongly the evidence supports a point of view. And in some cases, let's say major surgery, you want to be very, very sure that it works and that it's safe because the downside risk is very substantial. When it comes to nature contact, you may not need that threshold of evidentiary strength. Because the downside of getting it wrong, the downside of a type 1 error, if you were all wrong by raising your hands and declaring your belief that nature contact is good for health, what's the downside risk? Well, a few bee stings, a few allergies, a few cases of poison ivy, but it's actually not that bad. And the benefits may still flow in other ways, like physical activity and social interactions. So even if the nature piece is relatively low efficacy, we wouldn't be very sorry. It would be essentially a no-regrets solution. This is a concept that we know very well from the climate change arena, and this is a slide commonly used in climate presentations. The idea is, you know, even if we're wrong about climate change, the things we have to do are so beneficial that we can go ahead. We don't have to worry too much about being wrong. Trees offer a series of co-benefits, and this is the second point. The research that we do needs to be cognizant not only of health and social benefits, but of other benefits as well, because a full benefit accounting may lead to the following sort of conclusion. Well, nature contact seems good for health, maybe not that good, but pretty good. But if you combine the health and social benefits with the other benefits, economic, environmental, and so on, then clearly it's a win, and we need more parks and green space for those reasons. So trees are an example. Trees do all of these things for us that are environmental, social, urban design benefits. Toward the bottom of the list, I put mental health and spiritual fulfillment, the human impacts, the human benefits. But it may be that even if those are only a small part of the story, we still have enough to advocate for policy on parks and green space. So the conclusions I would submit to you are that nature contact offers many benefits for health and well-being. The available evidence is compelling and highly suggestive, but far from complete. There's an awful lot we don't know. In my view, we do know enough to act. And acting in this case means that we encourage contact with nature. We encourage policies that provide more parks and green spaces to people in urban and small town settings. There still is a role for research. There's a lot we need to know, and we will do better at designing natural settings for people if we understand better exactly what a dose of nature is and how the benefits accrue. We need to be thoughtful about our thresholds for proof. And this is probably an unfamiliar point, but I want to suggest that we don't need to be as demanding of the evidence as we do need to be for some biomedical phenomena that we also study. And we need to account for co-benefits, including those outside the health sector, because a full understanding of the benefits of nature contact may go beyond the health and social benefits to others as well. And that means that we need to get outside our comfort zone in public health and think very broadly. Thank you very much for your attention, and thanks for being here this morning.